Hey.
Hey, Michael, how are you?
In order to learn about music therapy, I wanted to first learn who it serves. And my exploration led me to Michael Detmer. He's a music therapist who specialized in working with infants, using music in order to promote healthy latching and feeding behaviors. One of the things Michael found out was that there's this whole body of research that supports the use of music in this practice. But there was really no way that was sustainable for parents to capitalize on this strategy outside of hospitals employing a lot of staff like music therapists. So he had this idea to create a product to meet this need, and he went for it. Here's his story.
So I went to grad school at University of Kansas, studied music therapy. And during my internship at Children's Mercy Hospital, I had a rotation in the neonatal intensive care unit and fell in love. I met a wonderful colleague who is now my co-founder. Her name is Rebecca, and she's a speech language pathologist. A lot of people that aren't familiar with the neonatal intensive care unit world are sometimes surprised that they employ speech language pathologist in the NICU because babies don't talk. But what an SLP does in the NICU is feeding and oral motor related therapies to support the future developmental milestones such as chewing and speaking, right? We started co-treating a lot on with these different infants, and she would often call me in on kids that she was working with from a feeding perspective to use music to help soothe them prior to her feeding, oral feeding attempts. She found that music and my use of music therapies with these babies would allow them to calm and coordinate, or what we call organize, their behavioral responses. They were much more effective and efficient in the feeding. We wanted to find a way that we could support the parents after leaving the hospital, and even parents that have kids that never were admitted to the NICU. A lot of children have sort of a blip during their feeding progression. So we developed this product called LullaFeed, like lullaby, but LullaFeed. The way the product works is it's sort of, you can think of like a coolie or a koozie cup that slides onto the bottom of the bottle that the parent or caregiver is already using. And there are a number of sensors in the bottom of the device that detect when the baby is actively feeding. And when they feed, then music plays back to them. And it's the parent's singing voice. The parent actually records their voice into the app in sort of a karaoke style platform. That then that voice is transferred via Bluetooth to the device and plays back to the baby. You can't just go to the baby aisle and Target and be like, "Oh, I'm going to buy this product that helps with feeding." There are just new bottles and new nipples. So we knew that there was a lack of product out there for this problem, and we also knew that the value of music was incredibly important in supporting some of these behaviors, which is why we built this to begin with.
My name is Tobin Richardson. I'm a counselor educator with a vision to save the therapist by creating a forever free podcast style platform designed for learning. Something strange has been happening to me lately, and it's something I didn't expect. I lost my dad last month from lung cancer that snuck up on him. He died a few weeks after he was diagnosed. And one of the unexpected side effects, for me at least, is that I'm suddenly very aware of the music I'm hearing. Like, I often have on Spotify or the radio during the day, but sort of in the background while I'm thinking about other things. And now, all of a sudden, there are so many songs that I can't listen to, like cheesy top 40 pop songs that otherwise I would have barely noticed. But now the chorus, or sometimes even just a single lyric, hits me so hard that I've learned to change the station before it even gets there when I don't want to tap into that emotion. And I think that says something about the power of music. As therapists, I think we try to ultimately get down to those big feelings with our clients and their struggles because we know it can be healing. But so often, at least for me, it just falls short, you know, like I just can't seem to get them there. But music does just about every time. So I'm here to ask to myself as much as to anyone else, why aren't we using it more? Like for so many of us, it's just not a clinical strategy that crosses our minds. And I think it should be. It should at least be in our tool belt. You know who else thinks we should utilize it? Music therapists. Up next, I talked to David Farsetti, who specializes in mental health music therapy, and he's worked at several hospitals and other settings in Louisville, Kentucky. From talking with David, he said so much that just intuitively seemed right to me, the way he explained it. But honestly, I just never really thought about it before, which I think is unfortunate. I worry I've missed a lot of opportunities for collaboration or to think differently about care delivery. Here's some of our conversation.
If you can do on a 1 to 10 scale of your first instinct of how you'd write the song and why.
Okay. And 10 being the most, a lot of therapeutic benefit.
Yeah. Okay. The first song is You Can't Touch This by MC Hammer.
I'm going to say a 3.
Okay.
No, actually, I'm going to give that a 4. That's a fun song. Yeah, which gets people engaged. It gets them listening, gets them active, and it relaxes them. But at the same time, there's a pretty easy transfer in there to make a conversation happen about boundaries. So I think actually, now that I'm talking it out loud, I'm going to bump it up. I'm going to say a 6 because I think that would be a really digestible way to introduce a maybe boring or sensitive subject about boundaries to people.
I don't know if this will change your rating, but just another piece of information in case you forgot this. It's actually, the title is actually like the letter U, Can't Touch This. It's not Y-O-U. So I feel like MC Hammer was kind of ahead of his time in that way, you know?
Yeah, definitely. He was giving us that text lingo before we even knew what we would all be doing.
Okay, how about Friends in Low Places, Garth Brooks?
Oh my God, Friends in Low Places. That song brings back so many memories for me. You'd actually be shocked how often clients request that song. I'm going to say the same for that one. I'm going to say a 6. Music therapists use patient-preferred music. Like that's golden rule number one. And so being in Kentucky, I'm seeing a lot of country music just day in and day out, which is, you know, I actually personally don't listen to a lot of country music, so it kind of pushes me outside of my my personal preferences.
All right, how about Lynyrd Skynyrd, Freebird?
Classic song. To be honest with you, I don't use Lynyrd Skynyrd often in sessions because it's so long. It takes so much time, and there's so much instrumental track that I tend to focus a lot on lyrics, right? But that being said, I do think that's a really common song for folks to use. And there's some good transfers in there with the lyric content. I'm gonna give it 2 scores. For me, in my use, I'm giving it a 4. For other music therapists, I think they would probably give it like a 7.
Yeah, you're right too. I'm just thinking of all the all the guitar riffs and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Music therapists are 2 like golden rules. One I already said is patient preferred music. We always try to utilize the music the patient or the client prefers, because that research wise shows is going to be the most effective, because they'll connect to it the most and you'll get the most rapport built the quickest. And then the other thing is live music statistically is more effective than recorded music as well. And that's for many reasons, but I won't dive into all that right now, but yes, because of that research, music therapists are required to, in order to get your MTBC, you have to prove proficiency in guitar, piano, singing, percussion instruments, and then one additional instrument of your choice. As a music therapist working in an inpatient setting, you know, I'm carrying around with me a guitar. Sometimes I tote around an electric piano if I feel like pushing a cart around. But you have limited access to what you can do. So the music that you use live oftentimes has to be able to be turned into an acoustic cover And so I try to decipher where's that line between, is this acoustic cover too different from the original? And so thankfully with adults, a lot of the music they listen to, a lot of the music you've asked me about so far is music that's, you can turn it into a cover pretty well, have a good time with it. It's still meaningful, impactful, and recognizable. And but with my younger patients who are the smallest portion of who I see, that's where I start to use a little bit more recorded music.
I'm thinking of the aspect of like how exhausting being a clinician can be in general, you know, like just the emotional labor of it. And I feel like that's a whole nother layer as a music therapist, you know?
I'm so glad you said that, Tobin, because a lot of people overlook that. And music therapy has an incredibly high burnout rate. I can look it up later and send it to you. So I'm gonna just ballpark here. I want to say it's like 50% or more of music therapists do not renew their credential after like at the recertification point, because it is an incredibly demanding job to be doing therapy, but to also in a way be performing. Although of course it's not a performance, but you still have to put in that effort to create meaningful music experiences.
This is interesting. I feel like how little I know about music therapy as a decade now, like working in the field. That's interesting.
Yeah, our worlds are oftentimes so separated, you know, even in the hospital that the hospitals that I bounce between, the music and art therapists have a separate office completely from the counselors and the social workers, because there's that, I think the administration sees that divide of the tools that we use instead of the underlying connection of we're all working towards the same therapeutic goals. We're just approaching that in a different way.
Who do you think music therapy works the best for?
So music therapists are a really generalized field, meaning that we work like, you know, like counselors and social workers do as well. We work across all populations from birth to death. And so while I work in mental health, that's my specialty. There are folks who work in the neonatal care in the NICU, right? There are folks who work in senior living homes with dementia patients. And then there is everything in between that people work with. So it's hard to say if there's a patient that benefits most, because there are such vastly different versions or brands of music therapy and what those sessions look like depending on the population you work with. So now that I've said that, I'm going to talk about mental health, because that's kind of my thing, right? I'm going to choose two for this, which is severe mental illness, acute severe mental illness. So in the hospital, right, as I'm sure many of the folks who may be listening to this have worked in inpatient care, units are usually divided by severity. So, you know, the unit that is considered the quote unquote most severe, even though that term is a little bit problematic, tends to be the unit that is neglected the most. Oftentimes, other therapies will mark a unit as not suitable for therapy because they feel like they are too acute or too severe to meaningfully or productively engage in a therapy session, which is understandable. I see where people are coming from with that. With music therapy, one of the superpowers of it is how adaptable it is. You know, when I walk into a room, no matter the functionality level of a group, there's always something I can do. There's always something, an intervention that I can pull out that's going to be productive and meaningful for folks, because that's just what music is. Music is accessible to everyone, no matter who you are, in some way. So whereas like maybe someone coming in with just a worksheet to talk about would struggle to work with a group that's, let's say, experiencing an acute state of paranoia or is in psychosis, active psychosis. And that therapist might say, you know, this group isn't going to benefit from this today, so I'm marking them as not suitable and I'm going to go on with my day. I can walk in there and say, okay, well, the intervention I had planned was really revolving around conversation based on, like, let's say a song, but they're not going to be able to really benefit from that today. So instead, I pull out a ton of instruments, right? We might pull out a whole set of, I like to bring in traditional drums from around the world, and then I lead them in active music making. So it provides opportunity for connection and community building without being reliant on the ability to speak abstractly about concepts. It doesn't put them in the hot seat where we might further agitate psychosis or further agitate a delusion, because we're focusing more on being present in a moment and making music rather than like talking and diving into things, like I said, that might further trigger problems. If you don't mind me telling a little anecdote really quick, that what you're saying now is making me think of one of my earliest experiences in music therapy. I was still finishing school and I was working in a general medical hospital at the time. And so what that means is that you kind of bounce floor to floor, room to room, kind of providing like ad hoc therapy services. If any therapists have worked in a hospital before, it's kind of true for all of us. You kind of based off a referral system. And I went into this room. I was referred by a nurse because a patient was at the end of life and they were actively dying. And their family was there, which included their children, their grandchildren. And the chaplains also came. So there were two chaplains in the room. And then myself and another music therapist both came because we wanted to be able to provide a really robust experience. And when we come into the room, everyone is silent, scared naturally, especially the kids, right? They're watching someone they loved pass away before their eyes, which in the hospital can be a traumatic experience, especially because you've got tubes and ventilation, lots of machines beeping, it can be a scary experience. And we started singing, the other music therapist and I, we started using hymns because we knew that patient was a really strong Christian. So again, patient preferred music. We integrated some hymns and Christian songs that we knew the family had said that this patient listened to in their life. And one, you see the effect on the patient because their breathing regulated a bit, their blood pressure regulated a bit, but you also see the effect on the family in the room. People's faces softened. They start crying, which is oftentimes a great thing to open that door for that expression to come out instead of being sort of stoic and stone-like. Folks started embracing. Everyone was singing together. The chaplains joined in and sang as well. And those were that patient's final moments. And the patient died while we were there that day. Sometimes you can be present physically with people, but you're not present emotionally, right? But music can be a way to kind of break us out of our like shell where we're stuck in our own mind and connect us even in those difficult moments. And now, of course, I don't know this next part, but I like to think too that especially for the kids in the room, but for everyone in the room, we hopefully reshaped that memory. And instead of it being the scary time that grandma died in front of us, it was the time we all connected spiritually, of course, because we're using spiritual music, and emotionally, and really celebrated her last moments. And I hope just that flip, in how we're framing that experience lasts as well.
Wow. And talk about an experience where like traditional therapy wouldn't work.
Sure.
Like in that moment, that just totally would not be effective. Right. So I hope like that something all therapists could just take out of learning from this is like, maybe you can think differently about what the client needs in different moments. Maybe it isn't always where your muscle memory takes you, like maybe sometimes you can think a little bit differently.
Okay. Absolutely. I think, it's honestly like a fun experience at times too, because social workers, counselors that I work with, well, oftentimes, they'll see what we do and they'll hear back from patients. And one of the big things is that music therapy groups at the hospitals I'm in tend to have the highest attendance as well. So people are coming to me, they're saying, what are you doing? Why are people coming? Are you just performing for them? Or are they just coming so they can listen? And so it's a great opportunity for me to sort of, educate some folks on what is actually happening in music therapy, invite them to come sit in. And then in recent months, there's this one social worker I'm thinking of in particular. She has started using music in her sessions, and to much success. She's seeing a huge uptick in people attending. She's talked to me about how she feels like she's making a lot more progress, especially in an inpatient setting when you only see people for a brief amount of time. It can sometimes feel like you don't have time to make progress. But I think that there is time to make some progress in that setting. And music is one of those ways that we can really kind of accelerate that rapport building, like I said earlier, and get progress happening faster.
Can you talk more about, I think a lot of people are just going to be curious what the training and credentialing process is like.
Music therapy is a worldwide profession, but just speaking about the United States, music therapy exists in every U.S. state. Music therapy, though, and art therapy as well, is if you or if any listeners are more familiar with art therapy, there are a lot of parallels between these professions. So in order to become a music therapist, you have to complete a music therapy degree. So that is a different degree from counseling or social work. And then after completing your degree, you have to do what's called a clinical internship for 6 months. And that is where you work, typically unpaid, under supervision for 1,200 hours. And then you're eligible to sit for your board's exam. And that's when you pass and you get your MTBC credential. Depending on the state you live in, depends on whether or not you get a license. So this is something a lot of folks, to my surprise, are actually unaware of. Licensure is state specific. Hopefully everyone listening knows that. So whether you're a counselor, a music therapist, a social worker, an art therapist, licensure laws are different depending on what state you live in. And counseling and social work are a little bit more ahead of the game than our professions are in the creative arts therapies, because I believe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Tobin, every state has licensure for counseling or social work. Every state has some version of an LC or an LPCC or an LMHC, something like that, right? Right. In the creative arts therapy world, not every state has licensure, but every state does have a national, we still have our national credential that we have to maintain, even if you're in a state that does not require licensure. So what that means, though, is not a difference of qualification. And I do want to speak on that really quick, because that's something many folks conflate. A license is simply a state regulation that says the state of Indiana has decided you can work here. And a license also represents the fact that the state agrees somebody who doesn't have a license and is pretending to be whatever your profession is could cause harm. So music and art therapy face a challenge where many state governments don't feel our professions could cause harm if somebody who was not a music therapist pretended to be one. And thus, we don't have licensure in the state of Kentucky right now, for example. I believe right now there's licensure in something like, I should know off the top of my head, 12 to 14 states, both for art and music therapists. So the majority of states do not have a license for those two professions. But despite that, here we are still working in psychiatric hospitals, working within healthcare systems and private practices. So it doesn't mean we're not allowed to work. It simply means the government is not regulating or double checking that we actually completed a university program, which, you know, is maybe a problem. Hopefully the government steps on that soon.
Yeah. So does that also mean that you're unable to like bill to insurance and Medicaid and Medicare?
Yeah, that's correct. So in states that do have a license, they can bill in the same way other licenses can, based on whatever the billing structure is of that state. In states without a license, there are some exceptions to this. On average, no, you can't bill as an individual, but you can work within systems. You know, for example, psychiatric hospitals oftentimes employ rec therapists, art therapists, and music therapists because they receive bulk payout from insurance payers just for programming. So the insurance payer doesn't actually necessarily need the person leading that programming to have a specific credential. They're just paying out like a lump sum per patient for that programming to happen. And so hospitals will oftentimes use those funds to hire creative arts therapists and rec therapists. However, in Indiana, for example, there is not a license for music therapists, but music therapists can bill Medicaid under the Medicaid waiver program. So there are many states that have exceptions to this where music therapists who have the national credential, they still do check that, can bill under the waiver program even if they don't hold a state-specific license. And you know, the American Music Therapy Association has state, what they call task forces, And those task forces' job is to advocate for music therapy legislation to be passed, amongst other things, other types of advocacy as well. But in Kentucky, for example, where I am, the Kentucky State Task Force has done an amazing job of working towards that goal. And a bill is currently on the floor for licensure to pass in Kentucky. And first and foremost, I have met so many counselors and social workers who love creative arts therapists. They understand what we do. They value us. They support us. But I've also met just as many who see us kind of as the cuckoo woo-woo, you know, oh, that's just the music. That's the music people. That's the art people. Like, I would encourage folks, if you are not familiar with this stuff, but it's happening in your workplaces, to maybe take a time to join those sessions and see what's going on.
One of the things I realized from my conversation with David is that I do think there are times that music can break down a wall. I think especially for therapists who work maybe in incarceration or with mandated clients or other types of community mental health, that wall can feel so insurmountable that it's hard to even be able to imagine starting to climb it. And I think these are times when creative therapies might be particularly effective. One of the complicated questions David and I really didn't have time to dig into adequately was how therapists who aren't trained in music therapy specifically might still be able to deliver some of those music therapy techniques effectively. From a technical standpoint, there's probably nothing stopping you from incorporating them into your practice if you feel prepared to do so. And if you're working in a rural area, for example, you may not have any other choice. There may not be any music therapists around. But of course, you should collaborate and consult when possible beforehand with a specialized expert. The gist here is that you just want to make sure you know what you're doing. You get the right information about best practices. Of course, you can also just talk to your clients about incorporating music into their sessions. Sometimes the client themselves might have ideas about how or when or why music might be beneficial. It might not even necessarily be songs with lyrics that you could incorporate. Maybe it's soft instrumental music that's helpful while you're practicing deep breathing, or maybe early in your sessions, just talking about musical preferences can be a way to build rapport, even if you never bring it up again. Or maybe there's a whole different type of expression that the client might suggest that could be helpful, like art or poetry. Just talking about it can help shed light on the option to think outside of the box, which is something that the client probably won't bring up unless you do first. In my clinical internship, I remember a psychologist at the center who, when she felt stuck with a client, at least once, she asked them to print out the lyrics to a song they'd mentioned in session in order to talk about why and how the words resonated. And I thought it was a really creative way to break through a stuck point. From what I remember, I think it worked. To be honest, I'm not sure how I'd feel about the incorporation of music into a session right now for myself as a method to heal from the grief I'm going through. Honestly, I think it's too recent, like my grief is too raw and I just wouldn't feel comfortable yet, which of course is a risk you run into with eliciting strong emotions. It's not always the goal. Sometimes it backfires and sometimes it makes things worse. So yeah, there are a lot of reasons, like with all clinical strategies, you need to be intentional and when possible, consult or collaborate with someone with expertise in the area. And I don't want to get on a soapbox here or sound preachy because I know we're all going to have our own complex perspectives on mental health interventions. But I do want to say for me, I'm leaving this exploration as an advocate for music therapists in a way I didn't even necessarily realize I needed to be before. David and I also talked about how support from therapists of all kinds, usually at the local or state level for music therapists, that's what's really needed in order to expedite the type of legislation that needs to happen in order to create structures for state licensure for this type of provider. And I, for one, am in. I'm convinced there's a major need, which this specialized type of care helps to fill. So I'm excited to be a voice of support, a friend in a low place.